bu ba bu ba bam ba bu ba bu ba 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 bu ba bu ba bam ba bu ba bu ba bam ba bu ba bu ba 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 bu ba bu ba ba
ba bu ba bu ba bu ba.
So true, Wendy.
I miss the baboobas.
Well, they're back. Hi, everybody. It's Bill and Wendy, and this is the bonus hour, the stream of consciousness. Welcome to the show. A little while ago, we were talking to Jeff Abraham. He's the author of The Show Won't Go On. It's a book that deals with personalities, celebrities who died mid-show.
Yes. Know?
So I didn't get a chance to ask him this. Do you know Curly Neal?
Yes, from the Harlem Globetrotters, who oddly enough had no hair.
Right. Despite the name Curly, he was without hair. He was in the middle of a game. The Globetrotters were playing a game, and he just collapsed, and the other Globetrotters were sure that he was kidding. And
so they threw the ripped up paper on him?
A bucket of confetti
they,
on
they,
him.
Honest to God, you're not kidding?
One of the yeah, it's true. One of the members of the Globetrotters took off first one shoe, then the other shoe, and put it by his nose as if to say it's like smelling salts. Like, this will wake up Curly. But it didn't because he was out cold.
Oh, my God.
They finally realized he wasn't kidding around after a couple minutes of hilarious hijinks. And they rushed him to a hospital. And they resuscitated him. They brought him back. And then he told the story himself, saying, hey, if I was one of them, I would have thought I was kidding, too. I don't blame anybody. But he, I mean, if that had gone on much longer, he would have died.
Well, that was the Nick Lowe story. You know, I knew the bride when she used to rock and roll.
Yeah.
Pub rocker Nick Lowe was electrocuted to death on stage in 1968, but brought back to life, a life made very comfortable after his song, What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding, which Elvis Costello covered and had great success
with. Yes, he did.
It was featured on the soundtrack album for the movie The Bodyguard, the best-selling soundtrack of all time.
Wait.
I didn't think that song was...
The Bodyguard is the best-selling soundtrack of all time?
That's
is it really?
That's what it says.
I thought it was the Bee Gees' Saturday Night Fever.
I would have thought that, too.
Huh.
Let's do a little Googling, shall we?
All right. And then I have the Lou Costello story.
Okay,
for
good.
You. But I will warn
Who's
you.
Who's on first?
It's very sad.
Who
very
died first?
Oh.
Too soon?
Yeah. Do you want me to tell you the story? But I'm going to warn you right now. For those of you who don't know, Lou Costello had a young son, Butch Costello, who drowned in the family pool.
Oh, that's
right. And we were talking to Jeff Abraham about whether or not Lou performed that night. So here's the story. This is from greatentertainmentarchives.com. I'm not familiar with the website, but they've got the full story. In 1943, Lou Costello and his family were living on Longbridge Avenue in Sherman Oaks. On the afternoon of November the 4th, 1943, while Costello was at NBC rehearsing his first radio show in a year, his wife Anne had put their son Lou Butch Costello Jr. into a playpen in the family's backyard. Anne Costello said that she looked out and she saw Butch in his playpen at about 2:30 p.m. When she looked out again a few minutes later, he was gone. She then pulled him from the water, that's from their swimming pool, and screamed for help. Two neighbors, Mrs. Bert Gutterman and Mrs. William Holmes, rushed to her aid, and Mrs. Gutterman began giving artificial respiration. Mrs. Holmes called for an inhalator, and firemen named Alvin Hull and Paul Johnson worked the boy for over an hour before Dr. Vincent Kovner pronounced the boy dead.
Oh, how horrific.
Horrible. Costello rushed home, arriving just as the firefighters were leaving. Grief-stricken, he wandered to the swimming pool and stood looking into the pale blue water for an hour until Dr. Kovner persuaded him to enter into the home and rest, this according to the newspaper. Although Jimmy Durante, Bob Hope, Mickey Rooney, and Red Skelton volunteered to take his place, remember he was rehearsing an NBC radio special, Costello insisted that the show must go on.
God.
He returned to the studio and did the radio show with Bud Abbott and with Lana Turner. At the end of the program, Costello rushed from the stage, his face streaked with tears, and Abbott announced Butch Costello's death to the audience. Lou Costello dealt with the tragedy in his own words in this interview. He said, the afternoon I went to a final rehearsal, Ann gave me a present from Lou Jr. It was a gold identification bracelet. I put it on my wrist, and it has never been off since that time. Kissing Anne goodbye, I said, have Lou listen to the broadcast and see if he recognizes my voice. Then I left home feeling that I was a mighty lucky man. At the broadcasting station, Bud and I were in the midst of rehearsing a comedy routine when I was called to the telephone. Even now, thinking back to those moments on the telephone, I find it hard to keep back the tears, for I was told that my baby son had died. He had fallen into a swimming pool and drowned. I left the rehearsal in a daze, and I drove home. All the time I was thinking, it's impossible. Only 2 hours ago, the boy and I were romping on the floor together. Now they said he was dead. I told myself it can't be true. There must be some mistake. But when I arrived home, Anne was in tears and told me what had happened. I knew then that it was all too true that our son was dead. After comforting my wife the best that I could, I went back to the broadcasting station. I did my radio show that night, not because I was following the tradition of show business, that the show must go on. No, indeed, I wanted to do the radio show so that my voice would go out into the air with the hope that Lou Jr. might still hear wherever he was. Again, I asked myself, why did this happen to me? This time I confess I found it difficult to keep my thoughts upon counting my blessings. The baby was constantly on my mind. Every little boy that I saw reminded me of the many things that I had planned to do with my son. Aww. There was sadness in my heart. How I managed to be a funny man in pictures and on the radio, I will never know. So the story that I had heard, not the one that I just read to you.
You are bumming me out today.
I know. I'm sorry. You're right. I am. This is just plain sad.
It is. Oh, my heart breaks.
No, but I had always heard that they tried all those names that I just mentioned, Bob Hope,
Jimmy
Mickey
Durante.
Rooney, Jimmy Durante. They all tried to talk to him and say, this is no time to perform. Be with your family. Be with your wife. And he said to them, I owe it to Butch, to my son, to do this show. I'm going to do the show. And then after the show was over, because the audience didn't know, and they loved Abbott and Costello, everybody was saying that we'd seen them before. That was the best they had ever been, you know, because something just kicked in. You know, he was doing it for his son.
That is terribly heartbreaking. And
horrible.
I think of his poor wife who, you know what? Accidents happen, and you know, I know people would go, why would you put him near a pool? Because he was in a playpen.
Right.
And yes, I guess kids do escape playpens. Didn't you escape your crib at some point?
I used to climb out all the time.
But I mean, until that first time, your mom didn't know you could do that.
Right.
So, I mean,
right.
It's just a terrible turn of events.
Well, you hear so many stories, not just in this instance, where a couple loses a child, and there's always that
the blame
game. Whose fault is it? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't she do this? Why didn't he do that? I don't know. It's impossible.
All right. On a lighter note, let's pick up
please,
the pieces of you.
Please.
Starting the show and now starting the stream. Dr. Death.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
We had mentioned Nick Lowe in this book, The Show Won't Go On, which it's available today. Jeff Abraham, we spoke to one of the authors.
I should stand in the corner for the rest of the show.
No,
I'm going to stand
we'll
in the corner.
We'll regroup. So then we mentioned that Nick Lowe wrote the song What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding, which Elvis Costello had a huge hit with, and it was on the Bodyguard original soundtrack.
Was the Bodyguard really the most...
Get over to the microphone. You're not...
Standing in the corner.
Yeah, but if you're going to stand in the corner, you have to face the corner. You can't just stand in the corner and look at me. Stop it.
I don't. It's been so long since I've stood in the corner, I don't remember the rules of standing in the corner. So you're saying if I stand in the corner, I have to face toward the corner?
Yes.
Oh, that's cruel.
Yeah, so don't do it.
I'm not going to do it.
But so this book said that it was featured, that song, What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding, was featured on the soundtrack album for the movie The Bodyguard, the best-selling soundtrack of all time, which you questioned.
I don't think it is.
It is.
It is?
It is. As of now, this from Business Insider, and I trust them.
I'm shocked.
Because of the song I Will Always Love You.
Yeah.
My Whitney Bodyguard. Houston? Yes.
Yeah.
The Bodyguard.
The Bodyguard.
My
Kevin
bodyguard.
Costner,
that
Whitney
was,
Houston.
What was My Bodyguard was with
That was Adam Baldwin.
Yeah. I bought that soundtrack.
And Matt Dillon.
He was in that too?
Yeah.
That's a good movie.
It's a really good movie.
This is the number one selling movie
and Martin
soundtrack.
Martin Mull is also in My Bodyguard, Wendy, just for record's sake.
of all time, The Bodyguard. 17 million copies sold. I Will Always Love You is the breakout hit.
If somebody said to me, $1 million to you, if you tell me the number one best-selling soundtrack of all time, I would absolutely say Saturday Night Fever with the Bee Gees. I'm shocked it's not number one.
Well, I am here to help you win that $1 million. This was published September of 2016, so 3 years ago, but it, you know.
The only soundtrack in the last couple years that I could think of that would even come close would be the Lady Gaga one from last year.
For Star is Born.
That would be the only one that I think would have even come close.
All right. Well, I don't have current ones because, you know, we don't work in current.
Nope. We work in the past.
My Bodyguard, Whitney Houston, The Bodyguard, the number one. The number two is Saturday Night Fever from the Bee Gees.
What is it trailing by?
2 million.
Because I could go and buy a bunch of copies of it and put that in the number one spot and win my $1 million.
You would spend $1 million. Here, let me see if I can.
I would do it. I don't have anything else going on today.
I'm going to see if I can get a... When I looked at the date, I was embarrassed. So I want to get something that's more up to date. Okay, here we go. Now, if they have a list that's easy to read. Oh, God, they got top 50. I don't want 50.
Do all 50.
Oh, here, let me go.
Are they
how about top 10?
Okay, top 10 is fair.
All right. The 10th highest selling soundtrack of all time. Don't even tell me.
What?
A pop-up.
I didn't see that. Was it a good soundtrack?
No, it's blocking my view.
Can you look around it?
I got it.
All right.
So number 10, Pulp Fiction from 1994.
I knew that was a good, well-selling soundtrack, but I didn't think top 10.
Remember Overkill's version of Girl?
Yeah.
You'll be a woman soon.
It's really good. Very good.
All right, so that is number 10. Number 9, top-selling soundtracks, oddly enough.
Yeah.
Number 9.
Yeah. Hard Day's Night?
Help.
Oh.
1965.
I bet Hard Day's Night is in there, too, I would imagine.
These are the top 10.
But Help should... Yeah, that's deserved.
The 8th one of the best soundtrack of all time.
Best-selling, not best.
Best-selling, yes. Oh, God. Is it best-selling? This is at Pitchfork.com. Rushmore, 1998.
Now, I saw the movie, and I love the movie, but I can't tell you what's on the soundtrack. I know the music was good.
Dude, I think these are just a matter of... I don't think it's the top selling.
Oh, it's just somebody's opinion?
Yeah, God.
Wendy, you know what I'm going to do on my computer?
Find the actual thing that I've been trying to find.
I'm going to see if I can find the top best
selling. All right, I got them.
You got them?
Yeah.
All right.
I got to do it.
Because honestly, did you ever see Rushmore? It's really... it's a great movie.
Yeah.
But I can't remember any of the music from it at all.
All right, here's the top 10 for real. Sorry it took me 3 articles to get there. Right. Number 10 is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? From 2000, certified units, 8 million.
That was a good soundtrack.
Mumford and Sons.
Yeah, it had a lot of... like country twang to it, but it was good.
It was pretty
good. And
it
fit the movie.
Although it's one above Grease, really.
Oh, that's hard to believe.
Well,
that's very hard to believe.
That also sold 8 million, so technically that's a tie.
Yeah.
All right, number 9 of the top-selling soundtracks of all time, Top Gun, 9 million units.
Danger Zone. Right? Is that why people bought it? Because of Danger Zone?
I guess.
And what's the... there's a song from Berlin that's in there too that's real popular. Yeah, that's Danger Zone.
Kenny Loggins.
Yeah. Kenny Loggins, it will amaze you how many soundtracks he's a part of. He gets his songs into these soundtracks. That's why he's so popular. But what was the song from Berlin that was in Top Gun that was
No
real
More
popular?
Words?
No. Is that it?
Sex?
No.
Berlin song.
Ding, 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 ding,
Give,
ding,
take
ding.
My breath away.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the one.
We could be on a charades team.
Yeah.
Why don't they have... I know they have inner radio station softball leagues. Why can't they have inner radio station...
I'll take on Mully and Handley.
I will take on Bob
Mully
Stroud.
Oh, mm-mm. You don't want to take
with
on Bob
charades,
Stroud?
I don't know.
He's pretty good with the music.
If he and Tingle go at it, I mean, I think we could beat him. Sherman might be good.
Yeah.
All right, 8 foot loose. Loose.
Another Kenny Loggins, right?
1984, yeah. Almost Paradise was Ann Wilson Heart.
Those are all hard to quibble with. Those are pretty good ones.
All right, number 7, The Lion King.
Oh, sure. I could see that. You say no to that?
I never saw it. So, Hakuna Matata.
Yeah, very popular.
What does that mean? Circle of Life?
It means no worries.
It does.
Yeah.
It does
not. It's in the lyrics. Yeah. Hakuna Matata.
Wait,
means
pause.
No worries.
Wendy, you've never seen The Lion King?
I know.
Oh, my
Julie Andrews
gosh.
Isn't in it. You can see
Her
it.
Her voice isn't?
No, you can see it.
I am not seeing it.
Why wouldn't you see The Lion King?
I don't have time. Now I got to watch other things.
Jasmine, write this down.
This hurts me.
This hurts all of us.
It hurts no one, man.
You got to see The Lion King.
Why?
What are you afraid
I guess
of?
I may have. I saw a play of it.
It's not the same. You got to go see the movie. See the play and the movie.
I don't
Read
want
the book.
To.
Get the coloring book.
That I'll do.
All right. That's better.
Number 6. These are the top selling soundtracks of all time from 1997. I'll say who it is, and you will guess it in a second.
All right.
Celine Dion.
Titanic.
Yes.
Her Heart Will Go On.
Yes.
Yeah.
The ship won't.
No, the ship didn't, but her heart will.
Yes.
That's... Now, other than My Heart Will Go On, the only music I know from Titanic is like a reed instrument just playing softly in the background. Like that all through the movie. That's
it
the only
was
other music.
Good.
Thank you. That's the only other music in Titanic other than her doing My Heart Will Go On.
Distant Memories, Southampton, Rose from Titanic, Leaving Port, Take Her to Sea.
But there weren't any big production numbers in Titanic. They didn't just start singing and dancing.
Yeah, I don't hear. Can we hear the sinking?
Ooh, there's all kinds of very reedy music in the background. That's all I remember.
Reedy meaning a bassoon, an oboe, something like that?
Yeah.
All right, this is the sinking music by James Horner.
But you wouldn't buy this just to hear this, would you? I mean, this is good you're watching the movie because it adds to the excitement of the ship sinking. But could you just sit there and listen to just this? I mean, it's good,
It's pretty beautiful.
Yeah.
What about Star Wars soundtracks? Those are the same kind of thing. They're very orchestral and...
Yeah, but they've got that Ewok song in the Star Wars ones that people love. People love that. It's very popular.
I just know...
Oh, yeah.
Is that from the cantina or something?
Max, that's good, too.
Is that Max Rebo?
I don't want to get this wrong.
Jim's listening.
You don't want the scorn of your husband on you on this.
Yeah, I don't want to know. Number 5 is Dirty Dancing.
Yeah, I can kind of see that. Wait, the 5th best-selling
Hungry
soundtrack?
Eyes is from Dirty Dancing.
Oh, right.
Eric Carmen.
Yeah.
I forgot all about that song. Forrest Gump is number 4, selling 12 million units from 1994.
I can't tell you a single song that was in Forrest Gump. I know it was all songs of that era. You know, it was all songs of the 60s. But nothing stands out.
Let's see, because I bet I remember it being a good soundtrack.
Yeah?
Hound Dog from Elvis Presley. Rebel Rouser from Duane Eddy.
He's Gump, he's Gump, he's Gump, he's in my head. Presidents of the United States?
That's Lump.
Oh, shoot.
Walk right in, sit right down, the Rooftop Singers. Land of a Thousand Dances, Blowing in the Wind, Fortunate Son, CCR.
I remember there
Sugar
being...
Sugar Pie Honey Bunch.
See, that's what I remember in Forrest Gump is it's wall-to-wall that stuff.
Oh, my God. Listen to this. Just listen. Every one of these is the ones I mentioned. Then you have Joan Baez doing Blowing in the Wind live from Woodstock.
Right.
Respect, Aretha Franklin. Everybody Must Get Stoned from Bob Dylan. Sloop, John B., The Beach Boys. California Dreamin', Mamas and Papas. For What It's Worth, Buffalo Springfield.
All right.
Jackie DeShannon, What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love, Break On Through from the Doors, Mrs. Robinson from Simon and Garfunkel.
All right, it deserves it.
Volunteers, Jefferson Airplanes, Let's Get Together, The Young Bloods.
Wow, you'd get a hernia just buying this album, carrying
turn,
it to your car.
Turn, 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 I know.
The Birds.
The Age of Aquarius from The Fifth Dimension, Everybody's Talking from Harry Nilsson,
wow.
Joy to the World, Three Dog Night, Supreme, Stone Love, Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, BJ Thomas, Randy Newman, Mr. President, Skinner, Sweet Home Alabama.
Everybody's Talking from Nilsson should only be in Midnight Cowboy. No other movie could ever do that song justice. It's so perfect in Midnight Cowboy.
It's pretty great. Running on Empty, Jackson Brown, Keeps You Running, Doobie Brothers. I'm ordering this.
You're gonna have to have a second mail person deliver it to you because they're gonna break their arms. It's
On the Run Again, Willie Nelson, Against the Wind, Bob Seger, and the Forrest Gump Suite by Alan Silvestri.
Sweet.
So that's number four. That
wow.
sounds pretty great.
Yeah.
Purple Rain is number three, 1984.
Was it an eight album set?
You just mentioned
140 songs.
Yeah, I don't know. That's amazing.
A lot.
Purple Rain was pretty great.
Purple Rain was great, yeah. That was number three?
Yes, number two, Saturday Night Fever.
And number one to this day,
My Bodyguard.
It's
not, I keep giving you the wrong, it's The Bodyguard. Why isn't The Big Chill on here? I heard
that
Steve Cochran mention
there.
That the other morning.
That was a really great soundtrack.
One of the best. Very Motown-y. Forrest Gump should be number one when I read back all those songs that were on there. Wow. That's what I have to say.
What's the movie with Natalie Portman and Zach Braff that's like 12 years old now? Do you know what movie I'm talking about?
The Black Swan?
No. Zach Braff wrote this movie and he starred in it. Natalie Portman's in it. And the soundtrack to that is fantastic.
Don't you have a computer right in front of you?
It's broken.
I mean, you're right there.
I know, but I got to hit Google, then I got to put words in Google.
Garden
return.
State.
Garden State. Did you ever see Garden State?
No.
The music in Garden State is really, really good. That's one of my all-time favorite soundtracks, and that didn't even come close to the top 10.
I need to see what's on it now just to make fun
All right,
of you.
Go ahead.
The soundtrack for Garden State, music from the motion picture.
Mm-hmm.
Don't Panic by Coldplay.
Yeah. Wendy, come on. Show some respect to Coldplay.
No. Nope.
Come on.
Caring is Creepy by The Shins.
Yeah.
In the Waiting Line by 07.
Do you know that song?
I don't know
that's
any of
great,
this stuff.
That's a great song, In the Waiting Line. It starts out with some instrumental, then the lyrics kick in. That's very moving.
Another Shin song called New Slang.
I don't think I know that song.
Colin Hay, I Just Don't Think I'll Ever Get Over You.
Yeah, Colin Hay from Men at Work.
Yeah. Carey Brothers, Blue Eyes. Remy Zero, Fair.
Doesn't do anything for you?
I don't even know
you
this.
You don't know these? Oh.
Nick Drake, One of These Things First.
I don't know that one.
Thievery Corporation. The song is called Lebanese Blonde, and it's by Thievery Corporation.
Right. Big hit. Huge hit.
Simon and Garfunkel, I've heard of them. The Only Living Boy in New York. Iron and Wine.
Yeah. Iron and
Who's
Wine.
Who's that?
Together, finally, again. You don't know any of these bands?
You don't either.
If you do go to...
Fru Fru did a song called...
Oh, Frau Frau. Frau Frau, Wendy. Fru Fru. Come on.
God, the world is ending if Phil knows more about this than I...
Frau Frau.
Jasmine, I'm sorry you're shaking your head. I've let you down. Frau Frau.
Frau Frau.
It should be Fru Fru.
No.
Fru Fru's way better.
Come on. That's hurtful.
We're talking about soundtracks and the top ones of all time. Frou Frou.
There's no band called that. It's Frau Frau.
What's Hot, What's Cold, sponsored by American Weathermakers, the 60 Minute Men.
If they were even thinking about you hosting American Bandstand, they're going to cross your name off the list now.
I don't even care. They can do whatever
Ladies
they want.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Frou Frou.
Somebody said St. Elmo's Fire should
oh,
be. I agree.
That's a really good soundtrack.
All right, should
that
we
is
see
a very
what's
good
on there?
Yeah. See if there's any frou-frou on there. Well, you're going to get your John Waite, because he did St. Elmo's Fire, right?
I don't know.
Yeah. Man in Motion, that's John Waite, the former baby.
John
but you could
Parr.
Say, you could say that about almost any of us. I'm a former baby, aren't you?
Man in Motion. Hang on. Yeah. Soundtrack. That was John Waite?
Yeah.
Shakedown by Billy Squier.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know any of these.
Really?
Yeah. It's, okay. St. Elmo's Fire, John Parr. He did
John
the man
Parr.
In Motion. I was right.
What did I say,
I made
John
up for
Waite?
My frou-frou.
Oh, no. Sorry.
I made it up for it. Shakedown by Billy Squier, Young and Innocent, Elefante.
I don't know
Elephant,
that one.
Elephant. Elefante?
Ella Fitzgerald?
John Anderson, This Time It Was Really Right. Is that the Yes, John Anderson?
I would imagine.
Fee Waybill, lead
of
singer
tubes?
Of the Tubes, Saved My Life.
Hmm.
Love Theme from St. Elmo's Fire. If I Turn You Away, Vicky Moss. Stressed Out by Airplay. Georgetown, David Foster. See, now I'm getting back to I don't know any of these. Hmm. I don't know if St. Elmo's Fire was that great then.
No, I was expecting bigger hits.
Mm-hmm. Big Chill is number 17.
And shocking it's not higher up.
Blues Brothers. I know you don't like the Blues Brothers.
No, I don't, but
the
music
was
great. Yeah, I'm surprised that one's not higher.
Oh, we have to break, and we have to do some news with Ryan Burrow.
All right.
We'll have more where this came from, because then I'm going to go through some of them. I know you're dying to know where Flashdance landed on this.
Where did Flashdance end up?
You maniac.
I'm a huge Michael Cimbello fan, as you know. All right, more after this. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Thank you, Ryan Burrow. It's Bill and Wendy. You can call us if you want during the show. Our number is 312-235-2525. That's the way you can call us or text us during the show. We're talking about soundtracks, the best-selling soundtracks of all time. Wendy, I mentioned this while you were gone on Friday. My wife and I went to see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh.
One of the interesting things about the movie was that we're normally, you got a 2-hour and 45-minute movie. You'd hear a lot of music from that era throughout the movie, and there is a little bit of it throughout. But almost throughout the entire movie, you're hearing commercials of that era, which was a strange choice. I liked it because it put me in the mindset of the late 1960s, but I was shocked that it wasn't more music-driven than commercial-driven.
There was some great music,
some good
in
music
there
in
as
there.
Well.
Yeah.
So tell me do.
Liked it, didn't love it.
Really?
Yeah.
Did Terry like it at all?
Liked it, didn't love it.
I loved it.
Didn't care that it was 2 hours and 40 minutes. Didn't seem to take a long time for the movie to go on.
But I agree. I didn't look at my watch once.
He's interesting, Quentin Tarantino, because he tells stories in a very nonlinear way. Sometimes stuff happens before the action or after the action. He tells stuff out of sequence. He chooses things. Like they always. Here's the part where I tell Quentin Tarantino how to write a good screenplay. They taught us in film school that in a movie, you want every scene to either further the storyline or the character. Don't put in a scene that doesn't do one or both. And he consistently does that. He puts in scenes that don't really further the storyline or the character.
I didn't notice that because I feel like everything advanced the story. You can tell me off the air because there are still enough people
who didn't. Yeah, I don't want to give away any. But believe me, some of my favorite scenes in movies, there's a scene in Fargo where, you've seen Fargo, right? Where Marge Gunderson, your sheriff, goes and meets an old boyfriend in a hotel. You know the scene?
I don't remember
There's this boyfriend from school who has a thing for her, and he sets up a meeting in a lounge in a hotel. And it really doesn't further the storyline. I guess you could kind of argue that it furthers her characterization a little bit. But at that point in the movie, in Fargo, which is one of my all-time favorite movies, that scene didn't need to be there, and yet it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie because it's like a break from everything that's going on. Here's a little interlude that doesn't need to be there, but I love that little break in the action. So
I get that.
You can use it to your advantage, and many filmmakers do. But in Quentin Tarantino's storylines, when you look at what the storyline is, you go, I'm not sure that needed to be there or that or that or that, but then the movie's over, and you go, oh, okay, well.
I liked it, and honestly, I was worried with the length of it being 2 hours and 40 minutes that I was going to say, oh, God, that didn't need to be in it. Oh, let's move it along. I could have sat there for longer.
If the movie's got your attention, it doesn't matter how long it is, right?
I really liked it.
Yeah,
I'm anxious to hear
it's weird. I don't know what else I wanted out of it, because it is kind of what I expected it to be. But I just know, because he's only made 9 movies. He makes a movie every 3 or 4 years. And when somebody's ratio is 1 movie per 3 or 4 years, you want it to be a landmark special moment. And it for me, it wasn't. I know a lot of other people go, that's the best movie of the year, hands down.
It was
maybe.
Epic for me.
Was it?
It really was.
Yeah.
I like the subject matter. I like the acting. I like the stories.
How many of his other movies have you seen?
I saw Pulp Fiction. Is Reservoir Dogs his?
It is.
Jackie Brown.
Yeah.
The only ones I don't think I saw was Inglourious Basterds.
Inglourious Basterds, which
I'm going to.
It's great.
I'm going to see.
It's really good.
Inglourious Basterds and
Django Unchained.
I didn't see that either.
Really good too. I think. Of his movies, and I think I've seen all of them.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if that I haven't seen all of them. Jackie Brown is my least favorite.
Yeah, I enjoyed that tremendously, but I didn't have an investment
right.
in it, really.
I know.
It was a good story, and I love Pam Grier.
Yeah.
I mean, really, I'm trying to even think how many. So how many movies did he have?
This is his 9th movie. And I think he only counts them, because it always says on his movie what number movie it is.
It does?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that only takes into account the movies that he's directed, not the ones he's written or co-written.
Oh, I liked all the Kill Bills, too. I've seen all
love
of those.
Love those.
Volume
1 and Volume 2?
Yeah,
so
I did
good.
Not see The Hateful Eight.
Oh, look. All right, so that was his last movie, and I went into that thinking, because I knew enough about it from previews and from reading reviews of it. I'm like, all right, this will. And then I ended up really, really liking that
you
movie.
Did.
I thought that was a great movie.
All right, so I'm just curious. Reservoir Dogs, was that his first film? Oh, True Romance, I saw too, and that's one of my favorite movies.
Now, that one he wrote
it.
But he did not direct it. But that's my favorite of anything he's ever been involved in.
And
I thought that was fantastic.
Natural Born Killers, it says story. So
yeah.
Did he write the story?
Oliver Stone is the one who directed that.
That was great. I enjoyed that as well. So Jackie
Natural
Brown.
Natural Born Killers has this scene in it that I still can't figure out if it's brilliant or horrible. And the scene is, you find out that Juliet Lewis's, her background is awful. Her family
yes.
life was awful. And they play it as a sitcom with Rodney Dangerfield
yes,
as the dad.
Yes, that's disturbing to me.
But it was so bothering when you watched it originally, but anytime I think about it, I go, I can't figure out if that was such an incredibly great move to play her tragic childhood as a sitcom, or what were you doing? Treat that with respect. I'm somewhere in the middle.
That was very, I remember that now. That was really super disturbing to see.
It had a laugh track.
Yeah, we went to a movie theater to see it. Jim and I did. And it was disturbing to me. But I got to be honest with you, that whole movie was very
yeah.
disturbing in many different ways
yeah,
for me.
Yeah, it was.
I think,
should have been. It was. I mean, that was his intent.
But that, I mean, now that I think back of it, it was so unique that I don't know. I think it was kind of an.
Maybe it was brilliant.
Yeah.
I'll go with brilliant. But if you ask me tomorrow, I may tell you the opposite.
That's fine. So, yes, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Pulp Fiction, Inglourious Basterds, Hateful Eight, Reservoir Dogs, Django Unchained, Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2, Death Proof.
Death Proof is interesting.
I didn't see that. Jackie Brown.
Death Proof is like 3 short movies made into one. And it's, I mean... Like all of his movies, because Terry said when it was all said and done, did it need to be as violent as it was? And the answer is, number one, you're telling a story that has Charles Manson involved, so probably. But I don't think Quentin Tarantino would sign off on a movie. I don't think he would make a movie if it didn't have some violence involved. That's part of his game.
Yeah, and I mean, it was violent.
It was very violent.
But I watched The Walking Dead, and you get used to it. I mean, when they're munching on a horse, I don't even look. It's like, oh, yeah, now I can eat ribs while I'm watching this. I could never eat while watching The Walking Dead. I still really can't.
But wouldn't it throw you if he made a movie and then you saw it, and at the end you go, there wasn't any violence at all in that movie.
Yeah.
What happened to Quentin Tarantino? He wants that to be part of the experience, the movie experience. That's part of his thing. So,
Grindhouse, Death Proof. I have not seen that. Sin City.
Now, Sin City, he didn't...
Partial direction.
Yeah, he's one of several directors on, so...
So I've seen most of them.
Yeah. I can't even... Of the ones you have not seen, there's not even one that stands out where I go, you need to see Django Unchained, or you need to see...
The Hateful Eight. Or Inglourious.
All of them are about, in my head anyway, they're all about equal.
I'm going to watch them all just so
they're
I can say
good.
I have watched every movie directed by Quentin Tarantino.
You'll see a lot of themes reoccur in his movies. You'll see a lot of the same actors show up
from time to
time. Even in this one, Michael Madsen's in it for a little bit.
Yeah.
Kurt Russell's in it for a little bit. There's a bunch of actors that he kind of uses freely. And good. I like when a director has a stable of people he trusts.
Too.
That's interesting.
I am a big fan.
Now, here's a little fun thing to look for in the movie.
Okay, in which movie?
In
Inglourious?
No.
Hateful Eight?
No.
Django?
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Okay.
He uses a bunch of actors from the era, like Steve McQueen. Damian Lewis plays Steve McQueen, and it's great.
It's pretty great.
It's really great. So do you know who the character in the movie James Stacy is? He's played by Timothy Oliphant.
Yes.
Right, so that's a real guy. That was a real actor in the late 60s. The last time you see him in the movie, they're doing a TV show together. And the last time you see them, he, James Stacy, gets on his motorcycle and rides off. The ironic part of that is, and it's not ironic because it was done on purpose, so it's the opposite
right.
of ironic.
But
the purposeful
most people don't
moment
know this.
That nobody would, is that... The real James Stacy got into a motorcycle accident after leaving work one day and lost an arm and a leg, and thus his career was over. He still worked in one or two minor things, but he never was considered to be
a leading man
type again. So the mere fact that they show him hopping on this motorcycle and then driving off is like just a very quick nod to the fact of this isn't going to end well.
See, I love that. I got goosebumps hearing you tell me that.
Yeah.
And the stuff with Bruce Lee, I have heard pros and cons about Bruce Lee, and he did have a very big ego.
Yeah.
I heard he was a very nice person, too. But that didn't, I know his daughter came out and said that was terrible and made him look like a jerk.
Right.
I didn't think anything of it. I didn't watch that scene of the movie and go, God, was Bruce Lee a jerk? I just went, oh, that's Bruce Lee. And I moved right on.
Right.
Like, I almost feel like if she didn't say anything... No one, I didn't think poorly of Bruce Lee. Did you watching that?
No, I didn't. But I can understand where his daughter would be defensive going, to a new generation of filmgoers who don't know my dad's story. If you only saw that, you would go, wow, I always thought that guy was a nice guy, but obviously he wasn't. Look at how mean he was in the movie. But to me...
I didn't think anything of it.
No, just... That was their interpretation. That scene's a good example. It furthered the story. It furthered both the story and the character along.
Yes.
Because it established how tough Brad Pitt was,
And when you watch Bruce Lee movies, he is much like that. Like,
yes.
This was a character of Bruce Lee.
Right.
So I didn't think any...
never write a, like, oh man, for years I've liked Bruce Lee, but after seeing that,
you ruined it for me.
How could I possibly like a guy who's that awful?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Well, I mean, you did like it, though.
I liked it.
You didn't love it.
I didn't love it. And I went in going, here comes a movie that I'm going to love, which you should never do. Why would I do that? You should always go in. That's why, like, when my wife picks movies out, I almost know nothing about them.
Yeah.
And then I'm always better off because I go, I came in not having any idea what this movie was about.
I didn't know anything about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Nothing at all?
I really didn't. And then when
isn't it better that way?
Yeah. And you waited a while and you knew more of it. So.
Yeah.
I just thought it was great.
I started reading about this. I mean, like I said, he does a movie every 3 or 4 years.
It gets hyped a lot.
So when Hateful Eight came out, he was already working on this, and that was 3 years ago.
Wrapping up our soundtracks, just because we started it and I don't like to leave unfinished business, because I wouldn't be able to sleep tonight.
Yes.
Top 20. We did the top 10. Evita's number 20, the soundtrack to Evita.
Oh, I guess. Best-selling. I can see that. That's with Madonna, right?
Did
she play Evita?
Yes.
She did, right?
In 1979, it debuted on Broadway, and an album was released that went platinum in the U.S. before Madonna got to it.
Oh.
So this is the 96 version.
All right.
5 million units it's sold.
Maybe Patti LuPone then.
I think you're right.
I think that's who played Evita there.
The jazz singer, Neil Diamond, 1980, sold 5 million. These are the best-selling soundtracks of all times. City of Angels, 5 million, 1998. I don't even know what this was.
I think I remember that.
Alanis Morissette has something to do with it. Space Jam.
Really?
Excuse me, number 17, The Big Chill, 1983, which we mentioned.
Yeah, that
and
deserves
then
it.
16 is The Big Chill.
Space Jam.
Space Jam, yes. I Believe I Can Fly was the big R. Kelly thing that pushed it over.
Right.
And Monica's For You, I Will.
I don't remember that song.
Nor do I. Flashdance, number 15.
What a feeling.
Pure Country, 1992. I don't know what that is. Not bad for a movie that only grossed $15
million. Pure Country?
And one you've probably never heard of.
I've never heard of that. Is Jeff Foxworthy in that?
No, The Little Mermaid is 13.
You might have a best-selling soundtrack album if...
Waiting to Exhale is number 12.
Oh, yes.
$7 million, 1995.
Toni Morrison.
And Babyface, Kenneth Babyface Edmonds. Grease, 1978, it was number 11.
Surprised that's not higher.
And then Oh Brother, Where Art Thou.
And then we start at 10. Wow. All right, we will close things off next. Kim, thanks for hanging out. What?
No, it was Ryan today.
Oh, Ryan, thank you for hanging out. Where'd they go? I just noticed they're gone. Stick around, we'll say goodbye. It'll get crazy. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Good night.
Time. Did you have a wonderful time?
Wonderful, Wendy. Wonderful.
Oh, I can't do it.
I used to get so sad when I was a kid. They used to run the Mouseketeer show in the afternoons. And when, you know, they would do the Mouseketeers, now it's time to say goodbye to all our friends and family.
Yeah.
I would get so sad. I knew it was going to be on again the next day. And I'm just like, come on, Mouseketeers. We just started. This is half hour is not enough.
You're so sentimental.
Oh.
It's sweet.
Oh. All right, that's it for today's show, everybody.
We're so...
Can you hand me a Kleenex, Wendy? I'm all teary-eyed now.
We're caught up in the Lawrence Welk theme.
Yeah.
But we got to go.
Yeah. All right, so that's it for today. Tune in tomorrow for more exciting adventures. Bye, Wendy.
See you later, wonderful friend.
Oh.